I'd like to welcome everyone here this evening. Sorry for our delay. We had a committee meeting that was very important. We now have all our board members present, so I'm going to call the meeting to order. First, please have your pledge of allegiance.
Pledge resolution for the problem with the boilers and such that we've been discussing along the way. Also under D to cover the cost of the boiler, that transfer won't be needed at this time. And also added two additional items to discuss is the lunch program. If I could get my first and second to amend.
Same two.
All in favor?
Aye.
We do have that executive session. I will now open the floor for public comment. If there is anybody here that would like to speak to the board. Thank you. We will close the public comment section and open the presentations, which I wonder what that might be. Holding our breath. First presentation. I'll leave that to our presenters to introduce.
Hi. Do I need a mic?
Probably we'll need a mic.
Yeah.
Welcome. Thank you for all coming tonight. It's great to see all our pre-K families. We're really proud of the progress that our pre-K program has done. And we can start our presentation. Okay, our agenda will be a brief slide presentation, and the children will come up front and do a sign to a song that they've been practicing really, really hard on. It's called A Wonderful World. But here at Beaventown Central School, it takes a lot of team members working together to provide a safe learning environment for our pre-K students. And I'd like to see if I can work this. Just to sort of give you an idea of the fun, we have in pre-K, all the play, but it's not only play, but it's a day of work and play in pre-K. I'm going to introduce a few members of our team. Mrs. Giselle Regan, Miss Cindy Grazian, myself as part of that team. But you know, it takes more than that. It takes our aides, who are Margaret George, Sherry Hubert, Edith Reed. And it also takes the support of our administrators, our Board of Education members, our special area faculty members. That's music, art, computer, physical education. They all play a vital part in our programs, working as a team. We also have our bus drivers, cafeteria staff, custodian staff, our community agencies such as JCDO, Adirondack Helping Hands, Plattsburgh Public Library, and we have a few people here tonight that represent them. We have Karen Richardson, Shasta Whitford, Brooke Ledoux, who's our occupational therapist. Shasta Whitford is our sign language specialist, and Miss Karen, as we refer to her, does our math program. I'll get into it just briefly, a little bit of that later on. Now, just for fun, you might if I get that right there. Kids say the funniest thing. Who remembers our link letter? Oh, I didn't think so. We pooled our students with a few sayings, like, don't bite the hand that is on people. Don't bite the hand that is yours. Don't bite the hand that's on a bear. Another thing we asked was, a penny saved is to buy ice cream. A penny saved is for people. A bird in the hand is caught by someone. A bird in the hand is eating seeds. A stitch in time is a band-aid. A stitch in time is something hooked to your shoe. And I like this one, a stitch in time so your clothes don't fall apart. Just a little historical event of our UPK program. In 1997, New York State implemented legislation to establish the UPK program, Universal Pre-K. Beatman Town decided to take the plunge and started a half-day program at the Red Shay City Building in 2001. In 2002, we decided to grow a little bit and implemented two half-day programs, two half-day classes, one at Beatman Town and one at Cumberland Head. Continued that level for another year. And then in 2004, we consolidated both half-day classes at the Beatman Town building. We had an AM and a PM building, which meant we served 36 children during that time. We increased our class size. 2005, we continued at that level. 2006 again continued at that level. And 2007 was a big jump. The implementation of one full day and two half day classes at BES, which means we served, it was 36 plus 18. Oh boy. a lot more children. 54 children. 2008, again, we took another big plunge and implemented two full-day classes, one at Beatman Town and one at Cumberland Head, plus a half-day program. So at that point, we were definitely serving 54 children, which is a great increase in services. And again, we continue. We're going into our 10th year, which is really an amazing thing when you think about it. Because our district is one of the... There isn't that many more districts that have served UPK for that many years. Some of the other districts have just gotten on board with UPK recently. Okay, briefly talk about some benefits of our pre-K program. Talk about four areas: home to school transition, adjustment to school environment, strategic planning for development, and preparedness for academic success. I'll hit on those four areas. First, I'd like to talk about the home to school transition, because that's a big one. We do home visits every August. We visit the home. I'm going to get to my notes here. Home visit is one of the unique aspects of our program. During this visit, we have the opportunity to meet personally with the families and introduce ourselves to the child. It's a very exciting time for the children to have their teachers visit them in their room, in their home. They can't wait to show us their room sometimes. It makes a huge difference to this child to have spent some time with their teacher before school. The home visit also helps families feel more comfortable and assured that their four-year-old is in the hands of a caring teacher. Because we've taken the time to explain bus procedures, classroom expectations, behavioral strategies, the curriculum, and spent time playing with the child in a comfortable home setting. It certainly establishes a basis for open communication between parents and teachers. In addition to our home visits, we also hold our open house before school starts, which also lessens the child's separation anxiety on that first day of school. They know where their classroom is, they get to know where their cubbies are, they get familiar with the building a little bit, their parents come in. It's sort of a really nice, comfortable way for them to be introduced to the school classroom. And the last 2 years, part of our transition has been including bus transportation, which is a really big deal, not only convenient for the families, but the children. Again, you're helping them develop independence and feel more comfortable in the classroom and the school environment. We have ongoing communication. We send parents, we have parent conferences, newsletters, phone calls that are made frequently to parents. Parent connection with the teacher is one of the most vital things to help their education move along smoothly. Parent involvement. We provide several opportunities for parents to participate in their child's learning experience. Field trips, classroom readers, Friend of the Week program, holiday cooking events. This is an area that I have always found vital in fostering a positive relationship with families. Children see their parents valuing the school and supportive of their teacher. That is a real plus, and I want to thank you parents for all the support that you started with your child and your teacher this year, and it's going to continue through your child's elementary years because you've got a foundation going here. I'll move on. The next topic is adjustment to school environment. Following routines and procedures, and cooperating with adults. I'll just kind of flip these up here. This kind of shows you our day. They learn routines. They learn how to be independent, follow directions. When you look at the whole day and what the child is learning, it's more than just academics. Yes, we're teaching the ABCs. Yes, we're teaching all those things. But we're also teaching bus safety, classroom safety, school safety, like fire drills, hallway behavior, cafeteria procedures and behavior. Daily routines and daily schedules. You know, there's a lot going on here in our classrooms, all three of our classrooms. Here again are some instances where we're helping them to adjust to our school environment. Being able to go through the cafeteria line, washing hands after you go to the bathroom, putting your mats away, getting some rest time, some help, you know, curriculum is involved in there. Okay, our next topic is strategic planning for development. When children are, everything we do throughout the day focuses on a specific area of development, social, emotional, physical, and cognitive development. That picture didn't come out so well. That's okay. Here we're learning a lot about responsibility, about taking care of plants and taking care of classroom pets, cooking, learning independence by zipping. They get so excited when they get to zip in through their zipper. You can believe how excited they get. Up in that other, the 1, 2, 3, 4, again, is procedures on half of the three numbers, second and third and fourth. Okay, sorry. Thank you. When children are working and playing, they are learning many social and emotional skills, such as working in a group by deciding when, how, and with whom to play with, taking turns, sharing materials, learning about perseverance until they get that activity mastered, such as folding blankets. That's the one that's missing, is the folding blanket. Again, learning to zip their coats and learning about responsibilities that they have every day. Next slide is about the physical development. Gross motor skills is a really big plus in some of our classrooms. They learn about balance, the ability to maintain equilibrium, body awareness, awareness of left and right sides of the body, major muscle coordination, awareness of the body position in space in relation to other objects and people. Those things are very, you know, they really help the learning process. We have fine motor skills. Without the foundation of gross motor skills, children often struggle with fine motor skills that are required for formal school learning. You know, we grow and learn with our gross motor skills first. Those are the things that we learn first, and then it kind of goes down to fine motor. Fine motor development takes place after most of the gross motor skills are mastered. Fine motor skill development involves precise movements of the fingers, stringing beads, small block play, easel painting, writing on the chalkboard, catching the toss on the beanbag, cutting with scissors. All those things that we do in pre-K are all part of the process of learning those skills. The next is preparedness for academic success. Here we learn about concepts of print. How to hold a book, where to start to read, left to right, what an author does, what an illustrator does, parts of a book. We're learning about listening comprehension, what happens first, middle, and last about an event, and answering questions about a story. Literature discussions. We're telling what is happening in a picture. The written expression, drawing a picture and dictating a story about an event, such as my spring vacation, learning that I can communicate with squiggles and written words, that strengthens my development of my small muscles, fingers. Okay. I'd like to introduce one of the unique things about our program is our sign language program. Sign language in preschool programs. Whoops. As we know, young children naturally love to move. So this particular activity gives them lots of opportunities to do that. Sign language helps memory retention because the more we use our senses, the more senses that are involved, the better it helps our memory. This sign language also complements the theory of multiple intelligences. So it's just a way that children learn. Mathematical reasoning is developed by patterns in language. Musical abilities enhanced through music and rhymes. And you'll see some of that tonight when children do their presentation. Learning English and American Sign Language together engages both hemispheres of the brain. So this is really active. Mathematics will be another preparedness for academic success topic. Everything around us can be better understood with mathematics. Preschool is a good time for children to become interested in counting, sorting, building shapes, measuring, and estimating. Thank you. Okay. We look at the calendar. It isn't just about counting the number, but why do we need a calendar? So we get into that sort of concept also. The block aerial. I just want to read you like a little excerpt here. It says, when I am building with blocks, I am using my imagination and creativity, learning about height, weight, width, depth, and length, experiencing patterns, symmetry, balance, and gaining feeling of competency, and learning to cooperate, share, and plan, and negotiate. That middle slide, all of a sudden, one day they were playing in the block area, and they created this construction piece, and I was like, wow, they really had to put a lot of thought into that. To start building it from the bottom up, and I think it was after this Karen came and did this construction activity. And here's Miss Karen from the public library. And these are some highlights of the activities that we do all around math and science. Ms. Karen presents What's the Big Idea to three UPK classes and two Head Start classes. Math and science skills are instructed through specific literature and small group activities once a month. Every month we have a different topic, and every month we have small groups and activities set up specifically for these concepts, such as patterns, measuring, comparing, number patterns, counting, collecting, sorting, construction, sounds, movement, same and different. We have covered every single one of those topics throughout the year. And this is the last slide that I have. Just had a little trouble with my hard drive. Anyway, preparedness for academic success is cognitive skills, it's processing information. And we do that through observation and describing things, such as seasons, temperature, weather, appropriate clothing to wear. It's all done through observations. The problem solving is developed through just simple things like puzzles. And what is that worm doing in the dirt? You know, why do they live in the dirt? So it's getting them to ask questions about their environment. Lots and lots of exploration and lots of inquiry. And that is my conclusion for UPK. And I would like to ask that Ms. Regan's class meet her over in that direction. So Ms. Regan's pre-K students, come on up. Graziani's class? Thank you. board is going to continue their regular board meeting at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, now that everybody's left. My name is Kathy Fuller. I teach AP Bio and forensics and other things. And this is my independent science research group. Five seniors who are going to leave us on June 25th. We're not happy about that. So let me just tell you a little bit about independent study science research. It is absolutely independent. I'll go on to the next one. This is actually last year's group of three. But the impetus to start this program was actually the Champlain Valley Regional Science Fair, which has been going on for 3 years now, coordinated between SUNY Plattsburgh and Clinton Community College. And so we have been competing for the past 3 years, I'm happy to say, and we've done well in all 3 years. But the impetus was there, but as far as I'm concerned, there's lots of advantages to doing independent science research. And first off, as a district, I think we promote the fact that we would like students to graduate from here and become lifelong learners. And so independence is very important in that process. These students will tell you that they had spent the first semester really doing a literature search so that they could identify a problem that they could work on. And then from there on, you kind of see the scientific method, or that all of you should know the scientific method because you were probably taught it ad nauseum for about 6 years in a row. But it's very important because we use the scientific method to reliably solve problems and that's what I want to use is the word reliable. So once we got into the second semester, they designed the experiment, they identified the problem, they came up with a prediction of an outcome, they collected, they analyzed, and of course they came to some conclusions or validation of their hypothesis. And I just want to mention that these students came on board with me. I had them all as AP students last year, and I watched them in class. I actually asked them if they would like to do this, and so they came on board. And they spent one day, it was Wednesday, was our day, every Wednesday after school with me. And a lot of times we were in the one of the computer labs working. But very, very independent. And some of the other things on the right that are very important on this process is collegiality. A couple of them work as partners, as teams, and then Rebecca worked on herself. But they have to learn to be collegial. They have to learn to collaborate. And those are all important in terms of where they're going next year and then eventually into the world of work. They have to be thorough, meticulous. They have to be creative thinkers. They certainly have to problem solve. And I think foremost at the end of this whole process is they have to learn that professionalism is something that we would like to encourage. And that's part of the competition part of the science fair. Being able to stand on their feet and be judged by professors who ask questions and they have no idea what is going to be asked of them. And I think they will attest that that is kind of an important step of this process. So I'm going to let them take over because you really don't want to hear from me. But the class of 2010, we're going to start with Rebecca Phillips. And her project was visible nutrient deficiencies in tomato plants. And this is Rebecca.
Hi. So I started my research by researching hydroponics, and that's growing plants without soil. And I wrote a DuPont paper just explaining hydroponics' importance to third world countries. And as you may know, there's less growing space, not as many employment opportunities in third world countries. So implementing hydroponics in those countries will help them. So that was the basis of my experiment. And in my experiment, I researched the correlation between micronutrient soils and its effect on plants. So for 30 days, I grew 8 sets of tomato plants. One was a control, and 7 other ones were deficient in 1 vital nutrient. And for the 30 days, I spent 1 day recording its growth, seeing the symptoms of the micronutrient deficiencies. And at the end, I found that growing plants in nutrient-deficient soils produces plants that are micronutrient. So if I were to further my study, I would see, is there a relationship between humans or animals eating these nutrient-deficient plants, and will they become nutrient-deficient themselves?
I just want to add that Becca will be going to Cornell next year.
All right.
Anyone?
Okay. That's not my
project. I'm Bern Rutherford, and this is Kayla King. We researched olfaction and its effects on short-term memory. The two particular olfactory stimuli that we looked at were peppermint, which is a known stimulant and has been shown in numerous studies to improve sustained concentration as well as recall, remembering things, as well as lavender, which is a which has mild sedative effects, so it may reduce testing anxiety. So we looked at a number of studies which examine both of those, and we're particularly interested in its application in education. So we focused on short-term memory and conducted a short-term memory test consisting of students and then a second one of teachers, in which they would be given a set of random letter combination, non-word letter combinations, with a certain number of letters, and they would have a certain period of time to look at it, and then the screen would go blank, and they would have to write down what they remember in the order they remember. And so they would get progressively more difficult as the trial went on, and we looked at the data. Surprisingly, we did not see any significant correlation between peppermint and increased short-term memory accuracy, which is something that's been indicated in past studies, at least with recall and sustained concentration. However, lavender showed a significant improvement, which we believe could possibly be attested to decreased testing anxiety. So that was some interesting results that we saw. And I believe we have a test that we can show you that we gave, so if you guys would like to try for yourself.
Okay. He's going to quickly break out of one PowerPoint and go into another PowerPoint, but this is actually one of the tests that they use. So you guys get to be the guinea pigs, except you're not going to really take the test. No test anxiety here.
You just have to press one.
Not one
about
my lavender. I need my lavender.
So it flashed 2 letters for 2 seconds, and then you have 3 seconds, sorry. And then you have 15 seconds to write it down. And then once those 15 seconds go on, you'll see 4 letters, and it gets progressively more difficult. We had 1 perfect score, which was quite impressive, because you'll see in our last slide that it's very difficult to get that one. I certainly could not have.
And Mr. Palmer, it was not you.
You can get the platinum.
That's the last one.
That's the last one. ESPN, I might be down.
Oh, there's the last one.
Oh, yes. That wasn't 3 seconds.
The person who got
it. Well, it's timed so that we have reliability, so that if we were to just click it ourselves with a timer, the results would not be as accurate. So we were able to time it so that it's the same every time, which is something we were really happy about. We went through a number of different ways of running the test, and this was really the most reliable, and definitely used a lot of problem solving to figure out how to do it with the least amount of potential, you know, issues. Yeah, exactly.
Here you guys.
Well, I'm Darren Spottable, and this is Megan. And our study was a study of allelopathy. And allelopathy is plants that produce chemicals, and they release these chemicals into the soil to prevent other plants from growing in their territory. It basically makes the soil infertile for other plants to grow, which limits competition for food and resources and nutrients. And we used thieves oil, which is all plant-based. I think it's lemon, rosemary, cinnamon bark, eucalyptus, and clove. And we tested thieves oil and each of its individual ingredients at 100%, 75%, and 50%. We used those against different kinds of bacteria. Is this the E. coli? We used E. coli. And we tested against, what's that? We used E. coli, black mold, and there was
Agrobacterium tumefaciens.
Yeah, Agrobacterium tumefaciens. These are all bacteria and fungus that attack plants. So we thought, since thieves oil was all plant based, we would use those, and it worked out real well. We found that in some cases the individual ingredients like cinnamon bark worked better than the thieves oil as a whole. It restricted the growth of all the bacteria, and we also found out that there were some that, like lemon, that went back and forth. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, depending on what bacteria it was used against. Anything else you want to add? No.
Did you look at black walnut?
We didn't. I actually did in my allelopathy paper that I did for the DuPont Challenge. I looked that up just a little bit to see that it also had the allelopathic chemicals, but we didn't really test anything of that.
And I'm happy to say that Darren and Megan received for first prize in the research division at the fair, so I'm very happy for them. Well, I'm happy for all my students. I'm happy that they participated. I think they learned so much from this process. I mentioned Becky now. Darren will be going to SUNY IT, Megan's going to Cortland, Bryn, Boston University, and Caleb is going to the University of New Hampshire.
Item 4, which is the presentation of the budget. And that will be with Mr. Aiden.
I just want to check the direction of my arrow here.
Okay, we're good.
Well, good evening. Most, if not everybody here tonight, if you're a resident, of course, of the Beacon County School District community in particular, would have received the presentation I'm going to share with you. This will be about the third different format that we follow. The first one, the third one, will be a budget presentation like this. There's two of them earlier this year. The second, of course, involved the report card and budget information that was mailed home to each household. And Duane has some extra copies of those. And the third, of course, is tonight, which is, the repeat budget presentation. I've taken the liberty of, because of those previous points of information for everyone, I've taken the liberty of taking a couple of slides out just to speed up and get to a section of questions and answers. There are any particular questions about the budget. But please know that if there's a question that I think a slide might better support it, we'll just kind of manipulate that, grab that slide, and we can show it to you. But very quickly, and again, I'll present to you, it's the same presentation that I've shared with you before, except that tonight, of course, is a new date. At the time of the, I'm going to click these up first and then talk about them very briefly. At the time we were planning the budget, we had a proposed gap elimination, or a reduction, if you will, in state aid that was expected to be in the area of $1,132,000. We also had to concern ourselves with withholding state aid payments that were being warned. At the time, you might recall, the governor was talking about holding back state aid payments to school districts, and yet we have a budget to develop, and we count on that state aid coming in. So we had to kind of work through some timelines and wrestle with that issue. There's lost interest income because of the concerns in multiple businesses around the state, actually. You can imagine that investment's not a really good word these days, so anybody who's got property investments or bonds, et cetera, lose interest on those rates. District's no different, and we lost some interest income. Property current property assessment increases. We based that on 0%. That's obviously a very conservative number. We know, pretty much know, that property assessments change yearly, but rather than count on a fixed number and be wrong in that estimate, we base our budget on zero, and then if there's any increases in assessment that are approved to the district, it would just benefit our, you know, benefit the district, and has a choice what to do with it, any additional monies that have been earned. Pending legislation, is now law. At the time, it was a pending legislation for retirement. Basically, the retirement legislation now affords opportunities for staff members to take retirement at a block of time, 5 years earlier, actually, without penalty from the state, than what it did earlier. The impact on a budget, of course, is staffing. We build on salaries and fringe benefits and health insurance and costs to run a program, and if individuals are retiring from those positions, there's some kind of breakage between the person following behind them, and that, of course, affects the budget number. So we had to wrestle with some of those challenges. That one in particular, we really don't have the full impact on yet, primarily because those folks who are eligible to retire with that new law do not have to make a declaration until June 30th of this year, and that window stays open through almost September. So we're getting input from our staff who are considering this to let us know, you know, this might be at something we're going to take serious consideration into, but we didn't have any real hard numbers to be able to build into this budget. Health insurance was an uncertainty. It's no longer an uncertainty. We know the percent of health insurance will be fixed for next year, and I'll get to that slide. And foundation aid, which is basically the amount of aid that the state guarantees each school district to count on every year to fund its programs, is frozen. The importance on that statement is that foundation aid by law, for several years by law, has been expected to increase for school districts year after year after year. And because of the economy and the governor's decision to freeze foundation aid, our amount of aid that we got from the state was fixed at a certain number, and it's been frozen there, like many school districts have. That affects the planning of budget, because you count on increases to discover that it's frozen. So where did that take us? We have so much assumptions, rather, that shape the revenue side of the house. Approximately $23 million increase in commercial property tax assessments. Simply put, that when commercial property taxes become available on the tax roll, that amount of increase, not the $23 million, but the formula used to derive the taxes on that, become eligible, if you will, for the district to count as a revenue. So we already know the early prediction was that at least a minimum of $23 million of new revenue that would be taxable from the commercial industry. We also counted on a 0% increase, as already mentioned, on non-commercial property taxes. That was the slide I mentioned earlier. There is a 0.78% decrease in state aid. That's based on the governor's proposal. We can't count on that as a lost revenue, if you will, but it's 0.78% lost revenue. Again, lost interest income has been listed. We can no longer call that revenue. It's actually lost revenue. And approximately $336,000 in some change estimated in lost pilot revenue. Pilot refers to payment in lieu of taxes. Those are agreements that are reached between municipalities and school districts to entice, if you will, companies and businesses into an area by delaying the full value of the taxation that they would have. You build a company, if your company chooses to build here, we'll have an agreement that will limit the amount of taxation that will occur for a period of time. But at the end of that period of time, that comes off a pilot and becomes fully taxable. So what we're experiencing, as I said, that $23 million, some of that is coming off a pilot, becoming fully taxable. $2.75 in this budget proposal to be applied from the undesignated fund balance. That's a board decision, heartily supported, by the way, to take undesignated fund balance and apply it directly to the budget as a way of offsetting the otherwise increased costs of the tax levy and tax rate. And $200,000 in capital debt reserve applied against the debt payment. We have debt that accumulates, and we have a reserve account that's set aside to make payments toward paying off the debt, just like you do in your household. And our district contribution is $200,000 toward that end. So, what does all that mean when we take a look at it? Well, we've got increases in salaries that are part of our budget. We know that there's a 6% increase in health insurance premiums. That was that fixed percent I talked about. We know that TRS, or Teacher Retirement System, is at 9% contribution rate, which is an increase from 7%. 11.5% of the contribution rate for employee retirement system is the same estimate that we used last year. So we can fix those costs into planning this year's budget. We have a 5% average increase in NERIC and BOCES charges. At the time we build a budget, we really don't know the actual cost for BOCES, but we do a historical trend analysis to determine it's probably going to fall in the ballpark of about 5%. So we counted on a 5% increase for those charges. When we break all that out into chart form, and it's pretty complicated to look at, but I'll try to be as quick with it as I can. It looks like this. Our current state aid budget was $11,485. We're actually showing an increase in state aid for that foundation aid. You might recall I said earlier the foundation aid is frozen, but in reality what happens is when the governor proposed the budget last year and froze foundation aid, the actual calculations to determine what our aid would be actually increased. So while it's frozen again this year, it's frozen at an increase of $126,000, which is always good news. Excess cost private aid also increased. These are all state aids, or aids, if you will, that our district qualifies for. That whole column that I'm pointing to are all increased amounts of aid over last year's budgeted amount. So you can see what's happening is that even though there was a gap elimination down here in the red of $1,132,000, the actual elimination costs, if you will, are somewhat offset by the increased aid in some categories. The subtraction of those two amounts brings us to a difference of state aid from last year to this year to be expected to be a negative $133,000. Now, as I've said in press clippings and also the mailer that we sent home, we're extremely fortunate. We're not in the situation that some of our neighboring districts are and that relatives of some of our patrons here are in. It's largely because we've applied a fund balance amount that other districts may not be in a position to be able to do, that we live in an area which has attracted business and industry that benefits our school district because of the location of where they choose to set up shop, and the rollover of pilot payments into full taxable income payments. All of those variables, if you will, contribute to our district being able to be in the position, financial position that we're in. But, whoops. Budget to budget. Ah, come on. Oh, yeah. Click it twice. Come on, Scott. Hello. Hey, Gary. You're going to love the slide if I can show it to you. There we go. Budget to budget. I'll be very quick with this again. This breaks down our cost of our budget in 2009-2010. Employee benefits and salaries and other pays amounted to $25,932,000. Which represents a percent increase of any operating budget of almost 71.5%. So basically, doing business from one year to the next with the same people will increase a budget 71.5%. Having said that, all of these numbers that you see in the red here representing decreases in budgeted amounts. Not only did we take advantage, we believe, in accounting on the revenues and being able to be able to claim additional revenues, we also were very prudent about cutting our own budget line items wherever we could. So when you put the two pieces together, increased revenue sources and decreased requests for spending, it has a very positive effect, obviously, on the, quote, bottom line. And for our district, even though it's a 71.5% of the whole budget, $37 million budget, is tied up in benefits and salaries, as it should be, because that's the people business that we're in. The overall increase from one budget year to the next budget year is only $402,640. major difference between that million that we were losing and actually running the district with only 402,000 more. That represents a total increase of 1.09% in spending. So on that chart that we sent home, you'll recognize these figures were blown up a little bit. Non-tax revenue increased $713,080. Real property tax revenue, the amount of revenue needed from taxation, decreases by $315,000. Total revenue then is $402,639. Budget to budget increase is 1.09%, which represents a 0.664 decrease in the tax rate. So on a $100,000 home, it's $67 less per net purchase of the taxes of that home. Tax rate is 1569 this year. It's a drop from even last year, which was 1635. And very quickly, budget history for concerned neighbors and friends who would want to watch trends over a period of time. This is what our trend would demonstrate to us. Beginning in the 2006-2007, you will see that the voters were asked to approve and did approve a budget that was $18.72 as a tax rate. When the actual calculations and the additional revenues were factored in, it became $17.86. What you see happening, of course, over the succeeding years is a continuous downturn of what's been requested of the voters for an increase in taxes and what actually they're paying based on that request. Both the requested amount is dropping and the actual tax rate is dropping. We consider those to be pretty healthy signs. And this little circle that you see up here on the right is to point out that, again, this year, we're not really certain we're pretty certain 1569 will change downward because of those variables that I just talked about. We count on 0% on assessment. We think that's going to change. And the $23 million of known commercial assessment, we think that's probably going to be increased as well. So the overall tax rate, which we're presenting for the budget for the voters to approve, will be 1569, but by the time the tax bills come, not to be surprised if it's a lower amount. And just very quickly, I won't spend a lot of time in this. We slice the pie up to say here are the total amount of dollars that are spent in the categories to fund schools, and you can see that the biggest percentage of it, as it should be, is 77% of the total dollars go to program supports, people who teach and the programs that they're teaching. Administration costs, which is all of the administration costs, central and building level itself, represents about 8% of that budget, and the capital portion of the supplies, the equipment, et cetera, to support the programs represents about 15% of the overall budget. This is the total budget is $37 million. You'll see that the real property taxes needed to fund that budget is 43.6%, while other revenues is a bigger slice. That's good because it obviously means the contribution the local taxpayer is making is obviously less than the revenues we're getting from other sources. And to put that quickly in context, I would show you that real property taxes, if you look over in 09-10, the gray area, real property taxes in 09-10 represented 45% of the budget came from real property taxes. And in 2010-11, it's only 43%. And other revenue sources in 2009-10 represented 55% to fund their budget. It's climbing to 56%. So again, we have another trend analysis showing, if you will, that while the real property taxes are decreasing, the actual contributions for other revenue sources have increased. That allows us not to cut programs, cut teachers, cut aides, do anything with our personnel functions to provide the programs and services that you've grown to come accustomed to expect. We've not had to touch any of those areas because of the composition that I'm sharing with you today. Summary, 1.09% budget increase of doing business over last year. Tax decrease in doing that business, 66 cents decrease. Tax rate, $15.69. Which is, again, as I showed you earlier, is a decrease. And we have contact information, which was also in your flyers that we mailed home and repeated up here. The guy in the bottom is much more handsome. the one on top, I might add. And at this point, if there are, I'll entertain any particular questions that either this slide was generated or may have come up since you received your information. We're good? Okay, the next thing to do is Greg, come to the polling place and do your thing. Whatever that is. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andy.
We didn't do a lot, so it was a good game.
All right.
But starting off, Charlie's my dad, Anderson.
Hi, Devin.
So, whenever you want to do next year, and also, before I start my presentation, I have a token of appreciation from the student council. You guys all made a chocolate bar, so I can take one and pass it down and
get it warm.
Can everybody hear me okay?
Yep,
you're good. Okay. So obviously a lot's going on now. Coming back from spring kind of break, everything is kind of shifting into getting ready for end of year tests. Last week was a new AP test. They went into this week too, but there's not as many this week. There was a recognition there for the top 10% for senior classes last week. This week we have, tomorrow we have, at the end of the day, an assembly. I think the band is going to be important. And I think the high school maybe, the middle school is going to do it. And we also have an activity period on Thursday where one period out of the day is, the periods are short, and then there's one period for students to get caught up on work and go see teachers. Coming up this weekend, there's prom on Saturday. And there's the after prom party as usual. And like this year, they actually had a mechanical bowl, a rock climbing wall, and many other things that's always there. So that should be pretty exciting. There's a lot of other things going on. As you can see, it's kind of a busy week, so I'm not even caught up with everything that's going on. But kind of the big story of this panel, I'm going to let you guys know about how I was one of the students that went on the trip to Europe. And I'm not sure if you guys are but it's definitely a great experience. So I'm just going to kind of tell you a little bit about that. So there's 27 of us. We left, I think it was a Thursday before spring break. The plan was to go to Spain. We were in Spain for 3 days, or Thursday, and we left Monday. We took an overnight train to France. And we were in Madrid and in Paris, or in Paris and France. And we went to all kinds of places. Went to palaces, chapels, cathedrals. Went to Prague in Madrid. We went to Toledo, another Spanish city. Lots of shopping, lots of. We had every day we kind of have a few hours of free time where we can go and see what we want to see or get food and stuff. Then in France, we went to the Louvre, the Eiffel Tower, Notre Dame. There's all kinds of stuff over there. It's kind of neat to see how everything's old architecture, narrow streets, so it's definitely different. We had a lot of great memories, and we really got along great. We're all a big group of friends. And we had a great tour guide. EF Tours was like who was providing it. They gave us 2 premiums a day. So everything was really great. And on Thursday, it was Thursday morning, and we were with 2 other groups, a group from Alabama and a group from California. They were smaller groups than ours. But one of the parents was talking about, from another group, she said, "You guys hear about that volcano in Iceland?" And it was just a few of us, and we're like, "Oh, no, you know, we don't really think anything of it." Then Friday night, or Thursday night, we were supposed to leave on Friday, and we had Thursday night, went to the Eiffel Tower, went on a boat trip down, I can't think of the river right now.
The same.
And, we planned for it to be our last night. We got up Friday, or Thursday night, my roommate gets off the phone with his parents, and, he talks, he's like, "Yeah, my parents are saying that all flights across the Atlantic are canceled." And we're just kind of like, "What? You know, we'll see what happens in the morning." So we got up early in the morning. Then I immediately checked out like a palm pilot I knew to kind of keep in touch with the email and check to see our flight status. And I page comes up and it says canceled. So that's kind of when we started wondering. But in our minds, like, you know, we're still got to go to the airport. If our flight's canceled, we still got to be there to try and get a flight out. To make a long story short, we didn't fly out Friday. When we first got there, Dev said just to hear that the other group that was supposed to be before us wouldn't be leaving until 9:15 that evening. We were supposed to have work back by 9:15 this evening. Well, that's a, you know, that's a big delay. But ended up getting a bus ride back to a hotel. It's in Marne Valley, Bruce St. George, kind of like a newer area outside of Paris. And they told us we have a flight for Saturday. It wasn't even dinner Friday night, and they're like, "Yeah, we can't get you out tomorrow." So we started realizing, you know, we're going to be here a little while. And but we still were doing stuff with the EF Tours, and So Saturday, we went to the Luxembourg Gardens, and we went back into Paris. We got a new tour guide and stuff, and then Saturday was supposed to fly for Sunday to, I think it was someplace in Switzerland, that would, from there it would be Monday, but I think it was Saturday night, that was already gone, so we still didn't have the way out, and we actually ran into another group from Tampa Bay, Florida, like at one of the restaurants, and they're like, yeah, tours group, and they're like, yeah, we're broken up in three groups flying out Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and we're like, Tuesday? When are we going to get out of here? So, what we were seeing there, though, we still did a lot of stuff. Saturday, the 6th of the Luxembourg Gardens. Sunday, we went to the Catacombs and Monet's Gardens. So, we were doing all kinds of stuff. And then, Sunday night was when we heard we got a confirmed flight for Friday. And we had actually, earlier, like the day we got canceled, made bets what day we could get out of here. The latest anyone bet was Wednesday. Everybody hated to hear that, so Friday was kind of like, wow. That's when we kind of started planning, you know, our senior Madden and Madden Rohrbach got in touch with teachers, you know, we're going to be missing the week of school, what's going to happen. And so Monday was kind of a catch up day. We actually, people were doing their laundry in the bathtubs. So Monday we decided to go to the laundromat to get the rest of our laundry. There's a local supermarket. So that was kind of the day off, just a day to get ready for the week. And then it was Monday night we find out we'll be taking a bus ride to Nice the next day, which is where our flight would be on. And Nice is a very nice place. So Tuesday was all day bus ride. We didn't get there. We left in the morning, got there at night. And then so that was a travel day. Wednesday was kind of like we explored Nice, right in the Mediterranean Sea. There's palm trees, so we're like, wow, this is like a spring vacation. And then Thursday we went to Monaco, which is kind of like an independent state in France, where it's basically, as Matt Hornbeck put it, the playground for the rich. And you see yachts and big houses. So it was really cool, it was really neat. And meanwhile, this whole time, keep in mind, we're getting our hotel for free and 2 meals a day still for free, all provided for by gift tours. While there's people, like, because there's so many canceled flights, there's actually people still being cared for. So we were very lucky. And then once again, we're like praying that nothing else happens with the volcano. And we got up Friday and we finally got home and we got back late Friday night. So it was definitely it was a lot of fun, I think. First few days when we were there, we were kind of like, oh my gosh, like we're going to be behind forever. But once we just kind of got into it, like, it was a lot of fun. We became really close to the fence and had a lot of great times. So, did I get
it's right.
Well, definitely, I was kind of upset we were stuck in France, though, because I'm a Spanish student. So, being stuck in France, it was kind of tough, but they actually speak a lot more English in France than they do in Spain.
Actually, they were flying out of Spain.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, there was a lot of flights coming out of the south, which is where we figured we'd have to end up at some point. But airports were going in and out. The other two groups that we stayed with, we left them when we left for Tuesday for Nice, because the California group flew out Thursday from Paris, and then the Alabama group actually flew out Friday from Barcelona and Spain. So, and then when I got back, it was kind of like, I had tons of work to make up, so it was kind of my excuse. Oh, I'm wearing a shame suit. Can you give me a break here? I didn't have much. Does anybody have any questions? Or
something you're never going to forget, Brad.
That's the one thing I love.
It'll be in your memory for years.
Yeah, and actually speaking of that, on the Monday when we did that catch-up day, a lot of us got journals, and we started writing about it. I'm not usually a writer, but I actually ended up writing there's a small notebook, but I filled like 60 pages of it. So I went the whole bus ride up and stuff. I was just writing, catching up on everything that happened, and every day it's kind of like what happened. So.
Excellent.
Well, we're happy you're able to put up with Nice and mine.
Yeah.
That
was really good. Yeah. Yeah. Take that like a trip.
Even the last 2 days, actually, the tours even gave us money for lunch, so everyone here was paid for. We had lots to say. A lot of us were thinking about just staying.
Is that another thing?
So
Okay, we'll move on to minutes. Resolved that the Board of Education does hereby approve the minutes of the meeting of the Board of Education held on the following dates, 4/20 and 4/22.
Richard.
The special board meeting way down toward the bottom, that assigns the Wheaton Town Central School Board to meet in CDBX.
Yes. Yes.
No more.
Sorry to read that. Finish it, I guess. Did you catch that, Joanne?
No.
Joanne, could I pass it on?
Yes.
The change is if you under the CBS.
What the
minutes of April 22nd. Special Board of Education meeting minutes April 22nd.
Where we voted change. For the budget or policies.
If you move down to organizational chart and job description on the left column. The change should read that third sentence should be from CBS for all administrative staff assigned to CBS rather than our district. Am I correct?
And that's amended. Yes. Any other questions, comments, amendments? Richard and Karen, will you amend your motion? Except the
yes.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Abstained? No. Motion carries. Resolved that the Board of Education does hereby accept the minutes of the committee meeting held on 4/20. The audit.
Richard?
Second.
And by Colleen.
Questions, comments, conditions, conclusions? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstained? No. Motion carries. Under new business, CSE recommendations. Resolved that Superintendent of Schools recommends to the Board of Education the approval of the CSE recommendation stated 5/11/10.
Motion. By Leonard?
Yes.
I'll second.
Questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstains? No's? Motion carries. Under personnel, appointments. Resolved that Superintendent of Schools recommends the Board of Education approve the following substitute appointments beginning on the date indicated. Richard?
Second.
Questions? Comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstained? Votes? Motion carries. Under B, resolved that Superintendent of Schools recommends to the Board of Education the following permanent civil service appointments as indicated.
Motion. Leonard. I'll second it.
Questions? Comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstained? Noes? I'd like to send out on behalf of the board congratulations on those two employees.
And we will follow that up, of course,
Thank you very much. Under two, retirement. Resolved that the superintendent recommends to the Board of Education accept the following intent to retire on the date indicated.
Second.
Leonard and Karen.
Who's the second?
Karen.
Questions? Comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstained? No. Motion carries. We're going to miss them. Under seven, miscellaneous. Resolved that the superintendent of schools recommends to the Board of Education approve adding the following supplemental textbook to the approved textbook list.
Richard.
Second.
Pauline.
comments, questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstains? No. Motion carries. Under policies, resolve that the Board of Education does hereby approve the following policy. It's the expense reimbursement regulation.
Richard. I'll second it.
Comments? Questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstains? Noes? Motion carries. Under B, resolve that the Board of Education rescind policy 1800 gifts from the public since policy 6255 gifts and grants basically replaces this policy.
Motion.
Second.
Leonard and Karen.
Questions? Comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstains? Noes? Motion carries. Under 9, financial, resolve that the Board of Education accept the following reports as presented by the Audit Committee.
I'll second it.
Thank you. Questions? Comments? Anybody want to peruse those? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstains? Noes? Motion carries. Under B, and this is the warrant report. Resolve the Board of Education acknowledge receipt of the warrant report for April.
Should be March.
March?
Yeah, March.
Oh, March? Okay.
March.
Change that to March.
I'll move it. Frank, and I'll second it.
Moving it with the March change. Second?
I seconded it.
Oh, who was first?
Frank.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Abstains? Noes? Motion carries. Under C, and this is the one you have in front of you, and we're rescinding the...
They don't have it in front of
them. See. Oh, they don't have it in front of them. Okay, I'll read.
I gave them my copy.
Okay.
No, that's
fine. Let me read the change. This is resolved that the superintendent of schools recommends to the Board of Education declare the need to replace the existing underground steel piping for the supply and return for the 20,000-gallon underground storage tank, which serves the main campus as an emergency situation requiring immediate action based upon New York State Department of Environmental Conservation notice of violation dated December 2009. All proposed work pending SEB approval. And if I may ask Dan just to kind of give us an idea of why we're going to that.
Yes. Excuse me. Speaking with the SEB today in regards to this project, and it was related to me that if the board was to accept this resolution, that it would expedite the process to the Department of Education. The notice of violation, I feel, is enough evidence to justify the status of the emergency of the affairs.
So SED is basically okay with that?
Yes.
Questions?
Are you setting an amount on the paper?
All this basically does, my understanding, is initiate an action, and from here we'll be coordinating with SED and the direction in which we'll be going. I believe that it would most likely be considered a project, and our architects have put together to go up with it.
So that'll be coming forth?
That'll be coming forth.
A future resolution. So we won't need a roll call on this.
There's no money involved.
There's no money. There's no money involved. Any other questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstain?
I'll second it.
Okay. Let's make it legal. No. We'll go to. All in favor?
Aye.
Abstains? Noes? Motion carries. Under D, resolve that superintendent of schools recommends to the Board of Education approve the following transfers. Of course, the second transfer of the $63,927 is not needed at this time for that hiking. So it's just to...
taking the second one out because we don't need it now. Motion by Richard. I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Yes. Frank Hay?
Yes.
Leonard King?
Yes.
Dan Karofsky?
Yes.
Richard Levine?
Yes.
Ed Marin?
Yes.
Carol Race? Colleen Stone?
Yes.
Steve Trombley?
Yes.
That's moved. And then we'll move to 10 additional items. Operations committee update. First up.
Well, we talked about the generator there that didn't work when they needed it, and they got a new board sent in, and the new board is wrong, so they are waiting for another board that's supposed to be right. So the phosphorus treatment plant, there was a problem with the pump. They had to replace that. The press box for the football field, that has been completed. They are doing 38 additional parking spaces for the district office. And the middle school loop, which has a drainage problem every time it's snow, water, whatever, they are changing that there. When is that going to happen?
As soon as school is out.
And we're also going to have the chain link fencing to the value of $18,000 within 4 to 5 weeks.
We'll start.
And I don't know, do you want to bring up anything about Excel?
It was $18,000 on the fence, right?
$18,000,
yes. Very briefly, the Excel fiscal advisors, as Ron mentioned earlier, and his report was on site, and part of their reason for being here was to look at our Excel project, see what's been, what's left, if you will. There is a possibility that there will be a balance left on the original project, so the board has a decision to make at some future point, not too far in the future, I might add, probably by the fall, as to what to do with the additional dollars that are left in the Excel project. And the Excel amount that is left is has been expanded a little bit because of the increase in what, draw the blank on the line, Ron.
Primarily due to the increase in the building aid ratio.
The building aid ratio. So the building aid ratio has, in quote, if you will, inflated the available dollars above what will otherwise be available. That means that the board has an opportunity to look at expanding the current project with a certain amount of money, which we don't know at this time, or it can choose to go out for a separate project and, you know, take a longer period of time to go out for a second project. And that's basically the update on that topic.
Be charged to look at that and, of course, start with the operations committee.
Yes.
Thank you.
If I may also add on to the Excel, because it's another last minute news break. SED has some preliminary give a verbal agreement that we will be going, that they will be given us permission to go forward with that proposed changes in the boiler room that I've been discussing in our status report, which is being processed this afternoon also.
Oh, excellent.
And that will be a change order on the beginning of the
project. Excellent. I thought that was going to be a little problem.
Yes.
Excellent. That's all we have. Any other questions or comments from the board? We'll move next to the West Jay-Z tennis court.
providing, if you know, in your update, it will be a brief synopsis of the request received from the town of West Jersey to consider contributing, or having the board consider contributing in one form or another, the monies that would be transferred or translated into resurfacing the tennis courts. Our tennis teams do practice on those courts, and they are, from a practice point of view, or actually from a playing point of view, I'm told that they're in disrepair, but they are practice courts. So the question that was posed to me, and it has for several months, you might recall, this has kind of been an ongoing what to do about the request, is that the board consider a way of helping the town offset the cost of surfacing those tennis courts. They'd like to do so immediately, and thought, being that we're our partners to the use of it, perhaps the board would be interested in contributing. An additional piece of information on that is talking with Mr. Lavarendo about the way in which that could be done. It seems appropriate that the district or the board could consider a rental agreement, if you will, between the two entities that would include any monies as part of the rental agreement, and with the understanding that the town would use that rental money, if you will, to resurface the tennis courts or contribute to the cost. So with that possibility on the table, the question remains, and I promised Mr. Spiegel that I would bring it forward for a discussion from the board so we could get direction to them. How much, if any, contribution, if you will, or rental agreement would the board wish to enter into with the town? The overall cost for the resurfacing, the total cost for resurfacing, I understand to be estimated at $18,000, but the contribution from the school district is whatever the rental agreement is crafted to be. So he was clear on that's the outside range, and then whatever, if the board was interested, whatever rental agreement you would propose and would be interested in executing.
Yes?
How long, I'm not against donating, how long would the rental agreement be for? And I don't mind helping them out and say we cost up half of it. Is that for 10 years or is it going to be for a few, you know what I'm saying? I don't mind helping them, but I don't want to get in the habit of giving the money all the time. You know, if you do a one-time donation,
you're renting it every year? Or?
Yeah, say no. How long would it supposedly last?
My understanding of the rental agreement is to provide a sum of money that would cover whatever period of time you wanted. The purpose for the rental agreement would be to have funds available to resurface.
Okay, but how long would one normally last?
Not every year.
I know, but how long would one normally last to have to be resurfaced again?
Oh.
They probably haven't been done in 10 years.
My question is how many weeks out of the year does tennis occupy the courts? Are they using the courts like for a 6 or 8 week time frame?
Weather pending, snow's in May, 2 months.
We're looking at 2 months, Mr. Hay.
About 8 weeks. Courts technically are probably open from spring until fall for town residents. So, I can't see doing a huge percentage to rent the courts. It wouldn't make sense. I can see maybe giving them 15% of the cost or to offset it. So you are even, 10% would be, $1,800 or $800? Would you say the cost was the resurface?
I believe the estimate for the total resurface.
$18,000. So in other words, 10% would be $1,800 to rent maybe for 2 years.
We also pay Plattsburgh State to host our, we have our home courts at Plattsburgh State, but on top of my head, I don't know what the fee is, but I know we do pay a fee for Plattsburgh to play there.
How much is that?
Off the top of my head, I don't know.
Just throwing this out there, has anyone ever entertained us having our own courts so that we can use them internally anyway for PE?
Do we have any more green space?
Yeah,
I don't think we do. Is that true?
Green space?
I think we do.
We are out of green space.
SED is not allowing us to do anything else on our campus.
Well, we have the wet, the wetlands that could be reclassified.
We could, and we do have property to swap.
I think we should be pursuing that because they're really not wetlands. I mean, I don't know why the state and the federal government classifies them.
I can tell you why.
There's a couple of
there's cattails and tag alders.
Yeah.
That's all you need to be classified. But we do have property that we can swap, and we should probably start working through that process.
We do need more green space.
I mean, I was going to mention that, if we're only going to use this for a few months, and if we're only going to put out just a small amount of money, it doesn't matter, but if they're going to want us to put out a good portion of $18,000, there's an argument that says, well, maybe get your own tennis courts in our best interest.
Yeah.
I don't know what we pay yet.
Well, our girls practice at the town hall. See, we have two. Our girls go to the town hall.
That was my question. Why
our boys go to Jay-Z, but the town. I don't think the town courts are any better than Jay-Z courts.
The town courts are in bad shape.
Are they a little better?
No, they're bad shape.
I know they're bad shape.
So, are they next to ask us to help them?
Well, if we help the one, I'm sure they'll help.
Okay, so quickly we'll get to the I have a tennis budget.
Just to make a suggestion, can we get, you know, before we make a decision on this, can we get a cost of having our own, or putting our own up rather than paying somebody else? Because I see if we do the one, the other one's going to want us to pay.
And we're still paying, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But we're still paying 5-6-8 to have our own mattresses there.
Right.
Because we have our own mattresses. And what would you need to have our own mattresses?
Probably sorry. Courts.
What would you need to have our own mattresses? How many courts?
Six would be
six.
Ideally six.
Six would be ideal.
Yeah, singles and doubles, trying to play simultaneously.
Eight would be nice, but six we could easily post a match six courts.
How can we use this as part of communication?
For phys ed?
Or
well, you could easily build your tennis unit within your phys ed program, without a doubt.
Another sport that was not could use it for skills. You're looking for it.
You can easily build it.
I think we need more information before that decision. Okay, what would it cost us to do our own rather than keep paying for everybody else?
And what's the total budget that
we I mean, if we might decide at a later date to help them out because we don't want to spend the money it would entail, but that's what happens. I mean, we don't know what it's going to cost. I'll say if we're going to pay a significant part of $18,001, the other one's going to want it, and you can build your own for $50 to $60. I mean, that is, I don't know very much.
Well,
Okay.
My response to their request will be no. Basically, I'll write it. That's it. And have it be no. Yeah, because you can't. They're making airport budget plans, like every budget plan is being made. So you need to know if they come out or not. And that's all I've been doing is trying to say, well, I'll try to get that answer to you as quickly as I can.
But my next question is, when you say that no, they cut off our access.
Oh, I guess.
That's what I'm saying.
I know what they did. I have no way. No.
That's what I'm saying. Where would we be if that happened? What happens if they say we can't use our facilities?
Well, Flash for Sale to say you can't come back.
No, I don't mean Flash for Sale. I mean,
well, for Sale.
They would say, well, we're not going to use ours anymore.
I don't know if they would say they wouldn't let us use them so much. They're just to let them go. There won't be any maintenance to them. And year after year, it'll progressively get worse. And they'll be at some point in time, they'll be unplayable. Mm-hmm. The town courts are they're getting close to that.
They're really bad.
They're bad. You know, the frost does an incredible job of fencing when there's cracks in it. The frost either.
Yeah.
We have no green space. Do we have green space to come ahead?
I'd like to research that first, the green space here, because I think we have plenty of space here.
We have space, but what SED requires as space is because of the amount of building square footage in your space. It's a calculation on, you have to have open, so much open ground.
I also would like an estimate of, if we look in the direction of doing our own, what that would cost. Because it, for me, right now, tonight, it makes sense to contribute a little something at least if we use the courts one third of the time that it's available to the town, and they resurface them once every 10 years. It makes sense to contribute something one time. I don't know. For me, this evening, anyway. Unless we get more information, make a decision on it.
Well, the question is, if we give them $2,000, are they going to use it, or are they going to resurface or not? They may not be able to do it anyway.
With that.
But at least we'll cover some maintenance.
I think Steve's got a good idea. Let's just put it off for another month. Get the information for our next meeting about what's been requested, and then make a decision at that point.
But the last meeting I remember sitting in 2 years ago with SED, so they basically were telling us that.
Yeah, you know more.
Yeah. You're not building anything.
Well, you're not.
No. But courts may not be part of the physical square footage of the.
They may consider that green space.
They may consider it green space.
Because it's
not a building, and it's something they can, it's outdoor.
Yep. So, yeah. I mean, it's worth looking into, even though we've been basically told. Doesn't hurt to ask.
Maybe Stan, we'll paint them green.
Well, they are green.
I'll just make it look up. Yeah, it's grass courts. Do grass courts.
Tell them it's going to be grass courts.
Wimbledon.
Okay, we'll move on to board meeting dates. The next meeting, of course, we do not have a second one in May. Because of all the things that are going on, and hope board members can attend. In June?
Next meeting is June 8th.
June 8th?
June 8th.
And of course, our organizational meeting set for July. And 2 points there. One, we are required by regulation to have it within the first. What is it, Joanne? We have to have it within the first week?
Well, usually you go the first Tuesday. You want to make
the
sure.
First Tuesday?
That's usually when you hold it. I want to make sure.
Right.
So that would be July 5th. And I think the holiday is the day before. The holiday falls on the weekend prior to the 3rd.
Okay, so the 5th wouldn't be a date that would be chewed up by the holiday.
Would not.
Would not. So our organizational meeting for
first Tuesday.
What's that?
It would be the 6th of July.
The 6th
would be the first Tuesday.
First Tuesday would be the 6th.
Okay.
The
6th?
6th,
yeah.
Yes, right.
6:15? 6? 7?
The 6th. Tuesday the 6th.
No time. Exactly.
No time.
Regular time?
Regular time, 6:15. You'll have your organizational meeting, and then right after that, your regular meeting.
It'll all flow together.
Yeah.
Well, remember, we had a time limit, don't we?
On
a meeting?
That's not my need. Yes, we have a very strict time limit on that. Okay. 5.11.10, the attendance zone policy discussion. Mr. Ingram will want to come back with that. So, you're up.
Yeah, just a reminder that obviously we do have a policy on the record, for the record, for the board's policy, I should say, regarding attendance zones. At the time the policy was written, there was some, was an uncertainty relative to our study of our building use, the numbers of students who are attending each of the schools. The group, the advisory group solution that's worked on that, I think I gave some preliminary information to suggest that our classroom sizes are not necessarily a critical issue, and enrollment projections for the next couple of years do not appear to be concerning, if you will, in terms of staffing, where kids are going to school, etc. So I brought back to my mind the letters I've received from individuals requesting variance or consideration to allow their children to stay in the attendance zones that they're in, as opposed to, because they're following the policy, make plans for making transfers to a different school site. When I read, or as I'm reading the letters and rereading the policy, I was again immediately struck with the opportunity for waivers was clearly placed on me. And I'm looking at the letters, trying to figure out the appropriate responses that I would give when enrollment changes are not predicted to be occurring in the near future. Our budget proposal that you heard tonight, which you certainly have voted on previously, contains staffing where they are, and it contains the number of students per grade where they are right now. So very simply, without any changes to the attendance of where children are now expected to go next year, there wouldn't be any of the, I'm not projecting there to be the kinds of burdens that we originally were concerned about when the policy was one of the variables that was raised when it was first drafted. So before I act on communicating in response to those written letters, I wanted to come back to the board and ask again, one more, or I guess, a confirmation or not, as the policy is currently written, would you want me to follow that policy in response to all of the individuals who've made requests for consideration? I can defend, as the policy currently asks me to do, I can make a judgment call on the nature of the letters and the circumstances that have been presented to me. It's just that it's as awkward as it sounds, making that judgment call.
Yes, Colleen.
When you're talking about the room now, teachers retiring, are you planning on hiring and keeping the same class sizes, or wouldn't that come into it?
Our budget is built on returning staff, replacing current classroom teachers, therefore some same class ratios would be expected to come as well.
Yes, Karen.
Would you help me with my memory? With the retirement incentives that are being offered, and I think I've read two different ones, so help me. Is one stipulation, if you retire under that incentive, that basically you can't replace the person? Was that something I read?
It has to meet some kind of criteria.
There was an original that was passed, and the governor added another piece to it as an extension of the original. The original was the, I kind of referenced a little bit tonight, the 55-25 ratio, that individuals could in fact register early retirement incentive without losing or being penalized by asking for early retirement. The one that I think you're referring to is the second one, which was a consideration presented to the legislature, but I don't know, I truly don't know if it's acted on because they're not in town a lot in the last couple of weeks, but it's a 50-10. Now the 50-10 piece, in order to say in order for number one, the district to, or for an individual to pursue that, they must first get permission from their board as a board resolution to honor doing that. The first step requires the board deciding, do we want to make that an option for individuals? The law doesn't make it automatic. It says it's up to each district to decide if it wants to. There are penalties, if you want to think of it that way, in terms of, as you can imagine, 50 years of age and 10 years of service carries with it some penalties on their long-range retirement. One of those has to be the piece you're getting at, that the retirement does not create the hardship on the district in terms of what to do now that person's gone and there's X number of them leaving. How can we possibly replace them? So it has to demonstrate your point. They have to demonstrate that in leaving, it's a cost savings measure to the district. So if we turned around and filled the position, obviously that would be important. If it ever gets to a resolution, you'd have to ask that. It would be a cost saving, but to save a position. It would be a question of whether or not the board's resolution allowing that to occur would in fact we'd be able to demonstrate to the retirement system that the individual could go with blessing, because in doing that, the district is not incurring costs for their going. Now that's kind of very wordy explanation of that attached piece, but that's
just
it.
One other, just for my own curiosity, how you read it. It said that the person retiring couldn't go back to work, and my first thought was, what if that person wanted to be a substitute teacher, for example? Does that prohibit that retiree from...
That's a good question. The original word didn't speak to the definition of work. It did contain the clause that you can't go back or all bets are off, so to speak. But I don't know if the bill even has attempted to identify or define work. I don't know if it did.
Couldn't go back to work or couldn't work in the retirement.
They just weren't paying their retirement.
Right. Could do other things work, but not into the retirement system.
If you were a substitute, you wouldn't be in the retirement system.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question? Here?
Yes, thank you.
As far as the attendance goes, I know we spent a lot of time on this policy. It took us quite a while to develop it and to come up with it. And I think we knew there was going to be some questions about it one way or the other. But because we took our time developing it, and it took quite a while, my personal opinion is that the exceptions should be very few and far between. There should be a very specific and very good reason why they would want to not go to the district that they are supposed to be going to. That's my personal opinion.
Well, it seems to me that the only thing that we really want to change, and it's under the stipulation of what's best for the child. That's the way I'm looking at it right now. And the only harm done if we use the attendance zones as they are is, for example, you have two kids that have been over here a couple of years, and now they're going to get ripped from all their friends and they're going to get sent to another school. Now that, to me, that can be a harm to a child. That's the issue. Do we want to make an exception for those children and grandfather that in and say, okay, you've been coming to this school, all your friends are at this school, and this is what you're doing. No, we didn't. No, you had to go to your tennis school.
Right.
So that's the issue. Do we want to make an exception into that policy and say, for example, if you're going ahead and you've been going to Beacon Town for 2-3 years, that you'd be allowed to stay there until, you know, you come over, whatever happens, you get to the higher grade. But those new people, because they're not going to be impacted that way. They didn't go to one school and now have to get ripped from another school. So that's what I'm saying. That's the issue. Do you want, you either want the kids to be able to stay or go? That's the issue.
We did something very similar with the tuition hikes.
Yes,
the kids that were in here, they didn't get hit with it. The parents did not get hit with the tuition hikes. It was new kids coming into the system. So I don't see a problem with, like, grandfathering
children. If they're already enrolled and, like you say, Red have friends and, you know, they've been in the school system for a couple of years. Just don't let it reoccur. In other words, don't let let it start in the K-1. You know, make them go to their original school. I mean, we did it for students with tuition that were paying tuition.
Yes. Yes.
One of the things that I'm concerned with, as long as they don't cost the district anything to be able to grandfather.
Well, the policy still reads that if it's going to cost and change the dynamics of the classroom, then it can't. So, grandfathering in would only allow them to stay up until the point that there is a problem with the district. It wouldn't change the policy. It's just the grandfathering part, which is bring them in. Like Frank said, very similar to the policy that we have for tuition. Tuition was changed for those people that are here. But any new student started, which means starting this year, and new students have to abide by the policy. Karen?
I just wonder, do you anticipate, let's say Pauline and I live by each other, and Pauline's child is grandfathered in. Now I move in, and I'm at the door, and I want my child to go to Pauline's, where her child's going. Do you anticipate that being an issue? Do you think that parent will just accept that Pauline's child is grandfathered in? You know what I'm trying to say, point out? An issue that may be an issue for Mr. Scott.
Well, one of the issues we had with the zone. Yes. One of the issues we had with the zone is what you're touching on, is that we had people that were turned down, other people were accepted. And it didn't seem to have any rhyme or reason why some were accepted and some weren't accepted. So that's why we drafted the policy, because we had people that were being turned down. So we made a policy so that it was by the letter. This is how it's going to work, and it's going to be fair for everybody. So will we have a problem with issues like that? We're going to have parents that are going to be complaining about that issue. But that's why you set policies,
right,
to address that.
I see both sides.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it's pretty easy. There would be no harm to that child. They weren't one
True.
Place. That's what I'm saying. If you go by the child, it's pretty clear cut. And we're here for the children, so.
Well,
yeah, I know what you're saying.
It's referring to whether we're going to get complaints.
Well, we're going to, but that's okay. That's your defense. We're not harming the child. We're not letting go of it.
But then you still have the problem that you had
people I know.
Turned down.
But it's a better problem than the other one.
That are going to come and say, look, you're allowing that person to stay,
right,
and you wouldn't let me even start. So why is it fair to them? So that's, yeah, you know, that's...
We're going to have a problem no matter what, but I think it's
right.
Fair.
Right.
Take care of the children.
What I'm saying is what we need to decide on is whether or not we want the children who are already across the attendance lines to be grandfathered in or not. That's all we have to do. Saying, do you want kids that are already over here and acclimated to one school not to get ripped back to another school? And that's the only decision we really need to make. Everything else is covered, I think.
Questions, comments? That's going to take a motion and a change to the policy to add a grandfather clause, and specifically add the grandfather clause specific to
I'd like to ask if it's all right, if Scott thinks that's all right, does that cause a problem?
Well, you're going to have to be careful how you word the grandfather clause.
I know.
If you've got somebody that was in kindergarten last year is going into first grade this year, by the time they're in third grade, if it creates a problem, what are you going to do? If you've written a policy to grandfather them in.
The policy says if it happens to be a problem with financial, what's the two pieces? Financial and
hardship.
Class size.
Yeah.
Then they're out. I mean, that's something they need to understand. That's not going to change.
The current policy also,
convoluted. But the current policy also is reviewed annually.
Yeah.
So know that at your disposal, if you're sort of move in this direction, you can make year by year reviews of that policy to determine if you want to change it because any of these variables are changes. But it will, the effect of it, obviously, is that there can be, theoretically, there can be families who will be starting enrollment under one policy and changing enrollment under another. There's no getting around with that. The only thing that will keep that from occurring, regardless of what policy is adopted, is that the variables that would cause the building to be bothered, meaning increased cost for staff or increased cost for transportation, don't happen.
Right.
And I only wanted to offer that in hindsight. I didn't pick it for any, it's a sensitive issue, obviously. But in hindsight, the building condition study that was done seemed to suggest for at least a relative near future a primary reason for having the policy may not be realized for a few years. So my immediate concern shifted to my present list of folks who are waiting for a response from me. That's why I brought it forward.
So will this help out?
If language to amend the current policy includes effective date, this is our policy. Keep the clause in for annual review, and all other enrollment patterns prior to that date will be honored. The question left for policy, and this is the one that we're trying not to answer and answer at the same time, and I don't envy that spot, but I'm in it too, is unalterable, or based on annual review, it could revert to something different.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't have to say that in the policy, but it gives you your purview as a board to know you have annual review of all of your policies. You can choose to alter your policy at any time, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years from now.
Would that be smart to put in the bottom of the policy, or just do it?
No. It's a spoken part of the policy. They're supposed to be reviewed.
I know, but you know how people are. It was on paper. Yeah.
But at your annual meeting, they will attest to the policy.
Yeah, so...
This policy requires that I bring to your attention annually any significant changes in enrollment patterns, etc. And so I would do that as a precursor to your saying, well, no need to change that policy yet. We'll go another year.
So,
or not.
So yeah. Would you have some language proposal for how to write that?
I think that would probably be something we bring back at another meeting.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to try to craft something tonight. It's just not.
Well, you better give us some direction then, because he's going to need to call it.
Well, just have a straw poll.
Well, yes, I understand.
Really? The next, and I'm thinking for planning purposes,
need some direction.
Yeah, so why don't we just go around and see?
Let's take a straw poll on whether or not we have board support. The concept.
Grandfathering.
That's a good idea. Of a grandfather clause. And that's all we're talking about right now, is just a grandfather clause. Frank, you left.
Right here.
Sure.
Do you have a policy with you?
Yeah.
They should be in the package.
Yes,
that's
okay.
The way it's presently written, isn't the superintendent given the ability to make these exceptions? The way the policy currently stands?
He's looking for clarification of that.
I can make the exception across the board on the premise that the board is fully aware I'm doing it as a grandfathering provision. I can do that, but it doesn't state anything in the policy. So I'm at the mercy of this kind group to remember a year from now that this is an agreement for me to reach that decision. And minutes would be nice.
I support the superintendent using his decision making process and grandfathering, if that's the word you want to use.
Okay.
Yeah, same.
Okay, Steve.
I still think we spent a lot of time on the policy and we wrote it the way we did. But I would prefer to go along with the opinion of the board. I don't have a strong opinion that's telling me no, but we've got to write the policy one way. I think we need to write the policy that way. We spent a lot of time writing the policy, and now we're changing it.
Yes, we did.
The way the policy reads right now, the remainder of this school year only, then they have to go back to their regular school. That's the way the policy reads. There's no exceptions.
Right.
That was the grandmother was put in here.
I will go on the grandfather. This is your partial supervisor, superintendent making the decision.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you to defer.
I was just going to say, I think I'll abstain from this one. I'll
support it for the good of the children.
Okay. So we will bring it back, defer to the That's why I said I don't want to try to work on it right now.
What's up?
I love support.
I mean, it's just.
So just wording it out always.
Do you have the board to revise the policy and bring back the next board meeting?
Yes. Chapter 4. There should be in front of you a 40 question test on Chapter 4. Has everybody got that?
Yeah, I sent it in.
Oh, okay.
It's in the mail.
Wait, you didn't pass that out?
File 13.
Nice. Let's see.
Okay.
As I try to, as I have done, I should say, with each time we talked about the book, and Brett, I'm curious with that extended vacation, how many chapters did you get done?
Yeah,
I understand. Okay. Because Brett, for the general audience to know this and embarrass the heck out of him, assured me that, boy, getting a copy of this book would be the next best thing, like getting Sports Illustrated or something. And I told him he's got several chapters to read to catch up, and he said that he's ready before he leaves the board table to entertain, get involved in the conversation. So I'll understand that, you know, the ash probably blinded your eyes a little bit and you had difficulty proceeding, so we can leave you out of the conversation.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Yeah, we'll go with that.
He was under immersion. He couldn't use English.
So far, in Chapter 1, the Wagner's identified that there are core competencies necessary for success in the world of work and college. We talked about that chapter. In Chapter 2, we stressed that there are core competencies that are not being taught in our schools nationwide, only the skills of preparing to take a test. That was the basic strong theme of that second chapter. In Chapter 3, we explored the nature of the test itself and what assessments that's focused on the 7 survival skills might look like. Now, remember, the 7 survival skills are on the backside of the book jacket, if you will. So this particular chapter, as I read it, and I would, again, just as a facilitator, pose a couple of questions for you to react to and think about, took a little bit different twist to it. This chapter seemed to characterize that there are flaws in the model of preparing teachers to teach. In other words, the process in which teachers go through to get certified to become teach. He's arguing from a national point of view, doesn't matter private school or public school, doesn't seem to be a variable. He takes issues with the training that is being given to our fledgling teachers to prepare them to lead students in the classroom. Takes a lot of issue with that. One of his biggest concerns is that the colleges and universities preparing teachers still focus on content mastery as their main objective, rather than these core competencies. So his argument in this particular chapter seems to be that if we're not providing opportunities for teacher education at the state levels to ask teachers to demonstrate their ability to teach students or work with curiosity and imagination to teach children critical thinking and problem solving skills, it's agility and adaptability. If all of the content courses necessary to get certified as a teacher preclude talking about those issues, we perpetuate the issue, the system, where core competencies are set aside and content knowledge, take a test. And we see that at the state level now, where you, in order to get new certifications, you have to pass a competency test in that discipline, in that skill area. But nowhere in those tests do they talk about these competencies. So that's his argument in Chapter 3. And what I thought was posing as a question is, did any of you reading that particular chapter see a parallel drawn between what the colleges are doing and focusing on and what we ask in third grade with third grade assessments? Is there a parallel between the two worlds? And that was the question I posed to myself. In other words, we ask third grade to do what? To demonstrate their learning. What do we ask the college teachers to do to demonstrate they're ready to teach?
We're asking about Chapter 3.
No, Chapter 4.
Okay.
Yep.
He's referring,
referring to the Chapter
4. Not one to the first three, right. To set the stage for the four. Yep.
The thing that jumped, I don't know if it answers your question, the thing jumped up to me that after, I read it twice, because the first time I went through it pretty quickly, then I had questions, but I noticed that they complain that we don't produce the kids the way they need them to go to college, and we complain they don't send us teachers the way we need them to teach.
And in part, that's what this chapter is about. You're suggesting that there are problems with the teacher education centers, if you will.
Right.
And he makes it a point of saying it doesn't, in his research, it doesn't mean that it's limited to a private school versus a public school. You know, state university system versus a private system. Both fail to address the core competencies in teacher preparation.
But the question that leads me to is, if we do produce the kids the way they say they want, is that going to get us a product back as teachers because they have those core competencies and they're going to demand that of their teachers, or their instructors as they go through? Because saying we can give them the basics, but if they go to college and they do the same thing that they're doing now, they're still not going to be ready.
Yeah, I think it's really a twofold, two-pronged approach. One is on before they leave the university. If he had his druthers, if I'm following you correctly, if he had his druthers, he'd have requirements or portfolio assessments, et cetera, at the college level, which would demonstrate that they've done some things in student teaching or field work to demonstrate they can teach people how to work in a group. What we do at the preparation stage is ask them about the pedagogy of teaching. The stuff to know what's the difference between Piaget and Montessori, for example, which is good topical conversation, but getting an A on that term paper is not what's going to get kids being collaborative in the classroom.
Right.
So his argument is we need to have the colleges focus on those skills more so than they are now.
They're still teaching to the test.
Still teaching content.
Teaching to the test.
And I just thought that was an interesting parallel. It just kind of hit me. It's kind of like what we ask third graders to do. We teach and get them tested.
But regardless of teaching the test, one of his main arguments was the fact that you put a lot of teachers into the same scenario evaluating, and they're not going to be able to spread across the board on the value of that course. And so the question, one of the primary first questions was agreeing on what good teaching is all about.
Yes.
And I mean, you're being very diplomatic, Scott, but he very strongly, quickly goes into identifying the capacity in the industry of identifying good teachers and poor teachers. I mean, I'll just throw that out there. You know, I mean, we're tippy-toeing around the subject, but that's the primary issue. Is first understanding what good teaching is, and then he sets up on the three conditions, which are getting the right people to become teachers, this first so selection process within the administration, developing them into effective structures. So that goes with continuing teacher programs and all that. And then after that, to follow through and ensure that the system is able to deliver best possible instruction. So where do we sit on those three?
Well, internally, as all school systems do by state requirement, have evaluation systems. He obviously, in his reviews of them, doesn't put a lot of stock in what they are evaluating.
Right.
Point one. What would he do differently with that? He would say develop more rigor in what we look for and demand of a teaching course. But he also goes on to talk about and what to do if we don't find it, which is where a lot of our hands in our industry are currently tied, about what to do if you don't find it. You've got a certain period of time to make that call, and a much harder period of time later to make that same call.
So based on this chapter, I wonder what the teachers think of the teacher evaluation form. Because one of the things that he talks about in here is the teacher evaluation form, and most places around the country feel that it's just something to fill out. It's not really of any value. So do our teachers feel that it's of any good use, and do the administrators feel that it's of any good use? All right.
Administrators can speak to their view of it. Teachers,
happy to chime in at any time.
A lot of work is put in. I read all of them, I will tell you that. And the model that we currently use does get at mostly gets at competencies of the craft, not a lot on the competencies in the book.
Right.
Is that a fair way of characterizing it, folks? I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth. And so to what they are measuring and reacting to, is the current instrument is a pretty decent instrument in that regard. But could, if that instrument included these other competencies to be measured, it would stimulate a great deal of conversation, I would think, building by building, as to, well, what does that look like? How do I do that? Why are you giving me that assessment on that competency? They'll start the conversation that Wagner's trying to get the whole organization called teaching and learning to do. Start the conversation.
I have a question. If it's going to be something that we cover later on, tell me. Because my question is this. I understand, having read the book, and I know I'm not supposed to, whatever. But the question that keeps coming back to me, there's actually two questions. How much can we deviate from teaching to the test? What I mean by that is, do instead of teaching 100% to the test, do you teach 90%, do you teach 80% really well, use other training techniques, creative thinking, problem solving? And that's how much can the board stomach? How much can the state stomach? How much leeway do we really have to say the state, if you drop below, like I say, if you go, like I say, and the grades drop 5%, now the board can say, well, okay, that's within my tolerance, and they'll come back up as we get farther in. But what is the state's reaction going to be to that, if we went that way? What would the state say?
It depends on what your AYP is.
I mean, we're a little restricted by what they allow, too.
Well, that restricts the teachers, too.
Yeah, I know. So I'm saying, you could say, God, I'm going to do 20%, just change it. But until we get the test grades back after we implement it, we don't really know if the state would step and say, no, you can't do that because it's affected your grades. And so that's my question. How much leeway do we really have?
Currently, state education policy would give you leeway, but not a ton of leeway. I'll just put it that way. The question of tests, how much time do you spend teaching content so you can pass a test? The state doesn't dictate that. The state doesn't dictate the sequence, for the most part, the sequence that you cover within the content. And the state only says 1 week, but we're going to design a test that gets at the skills, if you will, that we think you should know because you took algebra. Okay. So the test will be about algebra.
the test may or may not come anywhere near talking about working a team to solve this algebra problem. If you can follow that model.
Right.
So yes, there's a there will be a delay at state level to have changes in the assessment program to get close to match up with what he's saying is needed. But and having said that, that's the challenge. Now, is it an impossible challenge to push back? Apparently not. It takes, however, everyone designing systems at a school level to say kind of what you were getting at. Are we going to be okay when pushback comes in selling a more importantly believed message of what is coming because we're okay? Is it okay that, you know, we're not spending time on X, but what we're doing with that is teaching someone how to be a collaborative learner. If we can justify the value of being taught how to be a collaborative learner while we teach you X, there's the perfect storm, if you will. It's not a replacement for.
We just need to find
the how to get these skills infused into the content that the state is going to make.
So we just need to find the right fix for us.
Yeah, and for us that's space, that's freedom for teachers to interact with one another. It's about creating systems where students have time to talk about learning and know that they've got time during the day when everyone can talk about learning. It's doing those kinds of systemic things that he said will get us closer to these other outcomes.
Do the teachers have enough leeway to do everything?
This is a classroom teacher, and principal, please, I don't mean to steal a show here from your perspective because you're on top of it more than I. But classroom teachers have a pretty significant amount of autonomy in terms of day-to-day decisions. But the pressure points, right. I'll use the word, the pressure points to get to a point where the test score will say, I must be investing a good time here because look what happened when they took the test. That pressure point is a big one in many classrooms.
So even the state of the dictator.
Yeah, because they sense that the pushback is an uncomfortable
spot. The state doesn't dictate it. But the state gives us a curriculum that would take 3 years to actually cover in depth appropriately in 1 year.
Right.
So although the state says do it any way you want, it also says here's 300 days worth of material that any teacher who wanted to incorporate all of these things into his or her classroom, as long as you kept the same class for 3 years, didn't send them on, didn't take the test till the end of the third year, you could do it all. So, you know, they say do it any way you want, but what they actually give you says, because you never know what will be on the test, and it varies every year. What you think last year, oh, right, I'm going to hit it this year. There's two questions this year, and there were six last year. So you can't go on past history on what's tested on the test. So you've got to skim it all because you never know what's coming at the end. And that really guides a lot of the teaching.
You shouldn't have to skim it all?
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, if you ignore that whole curriculum and just teach the way you think it's important to teach, will it be that different in the results?
I think in the beginning, my personal opinion, is in the beginning your test grades would drop like a rock.
Really?
But what you are teaching your children is to think for themselves.
But it will catch up.
And to have an interest in what they're learning. And if we all look back at what we remember about school, we remember a teacher that probably taught us something not in their curriculum, but something they loved, that we went home and drew charts and put them up on our wall or whatever it was. So I think personally in the beginning, because there's such specific things that at the elementary level, we would see our test scores go way down.
How much?
But over time, I think we would see them go back up because right now we feed it. Somehow we have to have the children want to eat it. And that's where that change has to happen. They have to become more engaged in their academic careers and learning.
But I think those who reading the book, if you go that way, and I agree, you're sure it's going to take a shot. Stomach, how much can we live with?
It takes a long time to teach kids to think differently.
But once they start, you should be able to teach more of the content because they're going to be picking it up fast.
That's exactly right.
So you know, as long as you know your goal, I'm going to have to, you know, a year, maybe two, I'm going to be going down, but it should jump back up and then surpass it. at some point.
That would be
nice. Yeah, let's start talking about how much stomach do we have?
Okay, I need to, we need to hear from Pauline because she did attend the conference.
That is to the chapter,
In Lake Placid, and we'll let her finish up the discussion.
Yeah, the superintendent and I attended a day-long conference in Lake Placid on April 29th, and it fits right into this book. Attending the conference were representatives from the school districts around the whole area, local colleges, private and public employers, and the Workforce Investment Board. We saw that area schools and businesses see the graduation results. They don't see them the same at all, the local businesses around here. Now, 41% of school professionals said that students are prepared to enter the local workforce. Now, but only 3% of business professionals said that the students are ready to enter the workforce from the area schools. Now, statistics indicate that only 30% of high school graduates go to college. Out of that 30%, a third of them obtain a degree. Now, most young people in this area, in the late teens and early 20s, enter the workforce, and they are not prepared to enter the workforce. Now, employers want schools to focus on what they call soft skills, okay? Positive work ethics, effective verbal and written communication, promptness, okay, neatness, and work completion. That's what area employers would like to see students coming out of the schools with. The academic successes of students are not as important as the soft skills. That's what the area employers see. Now, business owners are willing to work with the schools by adding worksite tours, programs, and the schools would really like to work with the employers in the area for this, okay? Georgia Pacific was there, for example. They're willing to come to the schools with all kinds of programs, show the kids. They want teachers, students to go tour Georgia Pacific to see what it's like. You know, for a child that's not going to be going to college or a student that's not going to be going to college, what it would be like to work there? What skills they would need to work there? They're willing, there's a lot of companies in the area that are willing to work with the schools like that. Now, we discussed the National Work Readiness Certificate. Now, surprisingly, there weren't that many there that knew what it was. Okay? What it is, it's a course the students take. They pass a test. They receive a certificate. So, for example, if there's an employer that's got two students that they want to hire, they're going to pick the one with the work readiness certificate before the one without one. Because they've taken the courses, it shows that they're ready to go to work, they have all the things they need to work. Now, the Placer City School District Superintendent, Mr. Short, is looking into this further, and he's going to share what he finds with us. You know, he finds out the results of this work readiness certificate. And employers are looking for the soft skills, and they're looking for the same things that we've been reading about in the global achievement gap.
You know, I talked about this last year because I've had employers talk to me saying, "Well, that we got a kid from Beatontown that's not ready," and I said, "Well, what if we were to say, well, then send them back and we'll train them." So they are ready, and that's along that line because it gives our kids an added advantage, and I'm all for it. Because if you do that, then you're going to feed those kids right into the employers, so the kids will be employed.
And employers are looking for that. I mean, the area employers are looking for to get the students ready to work.
Some of those issues, though, being in the industry, are issues that are really taught by the parents, as opposed to the school.
Well, they discussed that was part of the discussion also. But they discussed that the parents aren't doing it. You know, what do they do when the parents aren't doing it?
It's basically no different than sending a child to CV Tech, getting ready for a job.
I'll close on this point. It happened tonight. When we saw the UPK program, and then you jumped to the senior project, you heard both talking about collaboration skills, critical thinking skills, problem-solving skills. So the field, meaning us in the field, know the importance of doing those things. The systems in which we ask people to perform that work precludes their time and energy to be able to do those things. And so when we talk about incorporating the major tenets of providing time for people to collaborate, of providing it's okay if a principal is watching you work with a group of students and what you're doing is 50% of a content and 50% of a process. We want you to concentrate on working well in a team, and when you're done, I want you to tell me why you thought today's exercise for you was good. What did your partners not do so well that would make it better next time? And by the way, talk to me about the history assignment as you do it. Right now, the systemic change is really the buzzword here, is what do we have to do, what do all schools need to consider doing to redesign how it does its business, because the practitioners are dying to do this business. The teachers are hungry to be able to do this without penalties, because they have
I want to just one question.
Quick.
One question, and it's kind of towards the staff. I want to see a look in their face.
Can you do it after?
No. It follows what you're saying, Scott. It follows what you're saying, but the question that it points here is, but I wonder to what extent the teachers' unions may actually be prepared to negotiate changes in working conditions and phasing out the tenure system in return for a better compensation, evaluation, and promotion system for teachers.
There's a book.
Is that realistic?
I haven't tried it yet.
just a really quickie.
No,
no more quickies.
I just have to take it off on the side.
You'll know when.
I'll tell you later.
29th, we will have an opportunity. I'll send you an invitation through my update. On June 29th, Tony Wagner will be giving an hour and a half teleconference for the district. And we'll be talking about these issues and questions in much greater detail. But mark your calendars. I'll send you the invitation on the 29th.
Yeah, don't leave that to you.
The author of the book will give us an hour and a half of this time to talk to you about.
I'm moving the rest of the additional items to discuss to June. Our next June meeting, because we need to go into executive session for some more work. So I'll open the floor for public comment. Closing the floor for public comment. Budget hearing, which we did, but our budget vote, just to remind everybody, is next Tuesday, the 18th. Come and cast your ballot. We do need an executive session, so I do want to resolve from the Board of Education to appoint clerk pro tem.
You.
Thank you.
I made the motion, Leonard seconded it, and we stick and stand and do the duty.
Richard and Leonard. All in favor?
Aye.
Those. Executive session motion. Second.
One.
Steve was motion executive session.
Can't come that long.